VOA, the science edition of Press Conference USA. Here's your host, Rick Pantaleo.
Welcome to the science edition of Press Conference USA. On the Voice of America, I'm Rick Pantaleo. On April 22nd, the world marked the 51st annual Earth Day. It started in 1970 as a U.S. national holiday that set out to call attention to growing environmental issues such as air and water pollution. Over the years, Earth Day has become global in scope, and the issues it highlights now include the threats of climate change, deforestation, and the depletion of natural resources. Many people credit Silent Spring, the 1962 groundbreaking book by biologist and environmentalist Rachel Carson, as the inspiration to the modern environmental movement and what would become Earth Day. The theme for Earth Day 2021 was Restore Our Earth. According to the website earthday.org, the theme focuses on natural processes, emerging green technologies, and innovative thinking that can restore the world's ecosystems. Today, we'll talk about the world's coming together for Earth Day and some of the key environmental issues this year's holiday aims to address. Our program today will be divided into three segments, each featuring an environmental expert who will address various aspects of the environmental movement, each with an expert on the issue as my guest. In our first segment, we talk with Kathleen Rogers, President and CEO of EarthDay.org. The mission of EarthDay.org, according to their website, is to diversify, educate, and activate the environmental movement worldwide. She joins us today by Skype. Kathleen, we just marked Earth Day 2021. How and why did Earth Day begin? Can you give us a bit of a background?
Yes. Well, you can imagine Earth Day started in 1970 on April 22nd, and it was the result of, I guess, the 150 years of industrial development, which had left quite pollution legacy in the United States and Western Europe and in many parts of the developed world. And as a result of that, people became much more conscious. There was more science. People recognized more and more that the impact of burning fossil fuels and burying toxics in neighborhoods was having its results. And they were everything from, you couldn't see across the street in LA during rush hour. Our rivers were on fire. We had oil spills. We had children being born with birth defects. The list of environmental disasters as a result of development was painfully obvious. And so a young guy named Dennis Hayes, who was a college student, joined Senator Gaylord Nelson, who had come up with an idea to focus on college students, but together they decided to take it across the United States. And 20 million people came out on the streets, which remains to this day the very largest civic event in human history. It was that big. And it had the intended effect of waking up the U.S. Congress and waking up the president of the time, President Nixon. And together, both the Congress and Nixon, in an amazing display of bipartisanship, passed most of the major environmental laws that are still on the books in the United States in quick succession. And many of those were exported by the U.S. to other countries. And so we have a rich history in not just turning out millions of people, but changing those people that we intended to scare, and they were our legislators. And that's the history of Earth Day. We share it today. There's a lot of volunteerism in addition to protests and town hall meetings, but the world continues to observe it, and we have a billion people today.
How has the focus of Earth Day changed over the years since 1970?
Well, I think, you know, we became a bigger and bigger tent. And sometimes that feels great when you're welcoming in everybody. And sometimes, given the environmental disasters around the world, it's really important that we steer all of those people in a more civically engaged and small p political direction. And that's not always easy. So if we're working with right-wing parties or conservative people who want to do something for the planet or their community, transforming them into activists and voters is really, really hard. So our mission has grown from bringing people out on the streets and engaging people in volunteerism to a very different mission today, which is to diversify the environmental movement and to activate them. And so our goals are to bring more people into the movement, work with them initially, but make sure they have the capacity and drive and interest to continue on their own. In American novel context, we call ourselves the Tom Sawyers of the environmental movement. And if you remember that book, a key scene is when Tom Sawyer has to paint a fence, but he talks everybody into painting it for him while he goes fishing. And while we don't go fishing, we do talk a lot of people into doing our work for us. That's the point of Earth Day.
Over the years since the first Earth Day, the celebration has evolved from being a U.S. holiday to becoming more global in nature. Can you tell us about some of the global initiatives of EarthDay.org?
Yes, so we are now in about 195 countries. There may be one or two that aren't fully engaged. But again, it ranges from citizens working with mayors, local elected officials, governors, if they have states, working with them to increase and promote broader commitments on environmental issues. And they can range from creating corridors for wildlife to working on transportation issues, regenerative agriculture and food, food safety, climate migration. So our partners around the world, and we have hundreds of thousands of them, faith groups, Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, you sort of name it in our world, they're all doing different things. We have something called the Great Global Cleanup, so we have massive cleanups going on worldwide, as well as massive tree planting. So we range from volunteerism across the globe to very activist things. In India, for example, their major programs on television, they're cleaning up the Ganges River and the Himalayas in some very visual and impactful programs. Across Latin America, there are days of conversations with mayors going on. And of course, we're holding three parallel summits to the Biden summit on climate change. So many countries are taking advantage of what was accomplished at the climate summit and are holding events to plan around and make commitments that will follow on those activities that we saw on Thursday and Friday at the climate summit.
Kathleen, the theme for Earth Day 2021 was Restore Our Earth. Can you talk about this theme and what it means to you?
Yes. So I think in the climate jargon, there were two things that everybody was talking about. They were talking about how to mitigate climate change, and they were talking about how to adapt it. And while both of those strategies are very, very important, how are we going to live with climate change? What can we do to mitigate it? I think we overlooked the third leg of the stool, which was restoration. And recognizing that, and in retrospect, we decided this theme way before COVID, the pandemic, but it seems incredibly appropriate now that we decided that we'd focus on restoration as the third leg of that stool, because we know we can use technologies. We know we can use natural systems like reforestation, regenerative ag, cleaning up the oceans so that our planet can in part heal itself. And then through technologies, we can remove the vast amounts of carbon that are in the atmosphere. So even if we stop burning fossil fuels today, we have 150 years, almost 200 years of fossil fuel burning that we have to remove in order to stop the climate crisis. So restoration is part of that.
Kathleen, you spoke earlier about a young college person starting Earth Day back in 1970. How do you see the role of young people in environmental activism today?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. So obviously, Greta Thunberg and Alexandria Villaseñor and Lesa Priya from India, and the list goes on and on of activists, have certainly got, you know, received a lot of attention. And we've seen youth movements come and go over the last decades. There were many, many efforts in the past to do it, but somehow these young people this time have really galvanized public opinion and have grown way beyond their own individual efforts. And so we created a youth climate summit a couple of days ago in honor of the 50th anniversary, and all of the big youth groups and many of the smaller ones participated and developed a set of demands, which they're presenting to world leaders as I speak. And so I think the difference now is they're very organized. Some of them are raising money. They've built their own capacity and they have enormous enthusiasm and they're talking to each other. So I really see a difference in this youth movement from previous youth movements. And I think it will have longevity for sure. And world leaders are listening to them. And of course, they don't want to be co-opted. So they're a little bit wary of all this attention they're getting, but they are true to their goals, which are really terrific, and focus on equity and inclusion and making sure that they have the right to strike, climate literacy, which is a very big one for them, and some other issues.
And finally, Kathleen, what can we do to help restore the Earth, not just on Earth Day, but every day?
You know, we long ago coined the expression Earth Day Every Day, and of course it applies. And EarthDay.org, the organization that I am engaged with, is the president. We focus year-round on plastics, on climate literacy, on a number of issues that are related to biodiversity, and of course, climate change. But the individual is critical. And in fact, we recently heard world leaders say that they are depending on pressure from millions and millions of their own constituents to keep them in line, to keep them focused. So the power of the individual is not just in turning off the lights and reducing heat and water. It's also that small p political action, which world leaders are desperate to know from their constituents and expect them to keep up the pressure.
Kathleen Rogers, I want to thank you so much for talking to us today about Earth Day and some of the goals of restoring our Earth.
Thank you so much. You're an important voice in the communication world, and I really appreciate your time.
That was Kathleen Rogers, president and CEO of EarthDay.org. She joined us by Skype. In our next segment of the Science Edition of Press Conference USA, we'll talk about the ongoing battle against climate change. My guest, also joining me by Skype, is Benjamin Cook. He is a scientist with the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies in New York. Benjamin, can you please fill us in on the current state of climate change? What have we learned about it over the past couple of years, and have you seen any new trends emerging?
I'd say over the last several years, some of the biggest things we've been learning is about how climate change is affecting extreme events, things like droughts, heat waves, floods, extreme storms. And this is really critical because it's these sorts of events that are having some of the or have some of the biggest impacts on people and ecosystems. So, you know, what we're seeing is that for many of these events, we're starting to see pretty definitively a what we call a climate change fingerprint. We're seeing strong evidence that climate change is already beginning to make some of these events more intense and more frequent in many regions of the world.
What's the difference between global warming and climate change?
Yeah, I mean, oftentimes people use them interchangeably. When we talk about global warming, we're usually talking specifically about the change in the global temperature, right? The fact that we've warmed up a little over 1 degree so far over the last 200 years, and that we're likely to warm up at least a couple more degrees by the end of the 21st century. Climate change is a bit more of a holistic sort of a phrase that kind of encapsulates the consequences of that warming. So not just the warming, but changes in precipitation, changes in sea level rise, changes in all those extreme events that I just mentioned.
And what are some of the prime drivers of climate change?
Well, the prime driver is really human activities, specifically the burning of fossil fuels. So, you know, most of our global economy is powered by fossil fuels, coal, oil, and gas. And a byproduct of using these fuels for energy is carbon dioxide. This carbon dioxide has been accumulating in the atmosphere over the last 200 years. And as a consequence, that's trapping more heat in the system, making the planet overall warmer and driving much of the changes that we're seeing today.
Can you explain a little bit more about the greenhouse effect? I've heard it used a number of times in natural climate events. What is the greenhouse effect?
The greenhouse effect is created by gases that are called greenhouse gases. This includes carbon dioxide, methane, water vapor, and a few others. These gases basically trap heat, so they keep our planet much warmer than it otherwise would have been by providing this kind of insulating layer around our planet that traps and sends some heat back down to the surface and keeps us warmer than we would be from just the sun alone. So the greenhouse effect itself is very natural, and in fact, the greenhouse effect is what makes our planet habitable, right? Without it, it'd be much too cold. But human activities are increasing the concentrations of some of these greenhouse gases, such as carbon dioxide. That's increasing the magnitude of this greenhouse gas effect, and that's resulting in overall warming of our planet that's driving a lot of the changes that we're seeing.
Keeping the rise of global average temperatures to below 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels is the goal of the Paris Climate Agreement. When we're talking about pre-industrial, what time period are they referring to?
So by pre-industrial, we usually mean before about 1850. Right, because it's really 1850 and onward when we really started to ramp up the use of fossil fuels and really intensified the kind of development of our economies and really began exploiting these fuels and driving these big increases in greenhouse gases.
What is the significance of keeping it 2 degrees above this level? How was the number reached?
The number itself, 2 degrees, itself doesn't have a whole lot of specific, strong scientific background behind it. Basically, 2 degrees is just being used as kind of a shorthand term for trying to limit the warming within a certain level. And, you know, it's much more important to think about climate change as a kind of continuum of possible futures, some of which could be very, very warm, some of which could be much less warm. And the key there is that the more it warms, the more we have to adapt and the more we have to change to deal with a warmer world. And the less we warm, then that allows us to avoid a lot of the worst impacts and makes it much easier to adapt to. So 2 degrees itself is less important than the idea of simply trying to limit the warming as much as possible.
Benjamin, has there been any talk within the earth science community that the 2-degree average is either too little or too much and wish to establish a new temperature goal?
There hasn't been much discussion about a new temperature goal, although the Paris Agreement also has another kind of stretch goal of 1.5 degrees. But one thing to keep in mind with these various thresholds is that they're differentially important for different parts of the Earth. So 2 degrees is very important for something like coral reefs, which are already in very warm parts of the ocean and already near their thermal limits. So much warming beyond 2 degrees could have very significant impacts on coral reefs. For other species and other things, a little bit warming beyond that is still manageable.
We're talking about a little over 100 years since the beginning of the pre-industrial levels that they're talking about. What is the global average temperature and what have they measured it as of late? And what was it back during the pre-industrial times?
Yeah, so pre-industrial is probably about 15 degrees Celsius, although if you go deep in the past, there were time periods when it was much warmer and time periods when it was much cooler. And since the late 1800s, the world has warmed up by a little over 1 degree. So we're very, very close to the 1.5 degree target from Paris, and we're a little bit more than halfway to the 2 degree target from Paris.
And one thing I've been seeing a lot about lately is rapid glacier melt in Antarctica and Greenland. How much is it accelerating and what's the impact it will have if these glaciers continue to melt?
Yeah, so one of the clearest impacts we're already seeing from this warming, even just 1 degree of warming, is widespread melt of sea ice sheets on land, such as in Antarctica and Greenland, and glaciers in high mountain areas. And one of the biggest impacts for the ice that's on land is sea level rise. So those landlocked glaciers on mostly Greenland, but also Antarctica and these mountain areas, once that ice melts, that water eventually winds up in the oceans and contributes to sea level rise, which has impacts and increases things like coastal flooding, saltwater intrusion into coastal aquifers, and can have very, very large impacts on coastal populations.
You had mentioned extreme weather a little earlier. What other events are showing that climate change is real and is already affecting our planet?
We can go out, we can measure, you know, how the world has warmed. And then pretty much everywhere we look around the natural world, we see changes that are all consistent with that warming. So we're seeing earlier flowering dates for plants, including, for example, the cherry blossoms in Washington, D.C., or the cherries in Japan, in Kyoto. We're seeing increases in agricultural and ecological pests, including bark beetles out west. We're seeing more extreme wildfires, increased drought severity, more intense and frequent heat waves, and much more intense rainstorms. So pretty much everywhere we look in the world, we see some sort of imprint or fingerprint of this warming. And it's pretty remarkable because, again, so far we've only warmed up by about 1 degree. And we're looking at 2-3 degrees probably by the end of the 21st century. So even 1 degree is having a large impact, and that portends even greater impacts if we allow the warming to continue.
Have we already reached a tipping point where climate change could be permanent?
It's permanent in the sense of, because it's very hard to remove CO2 from the atmosphere, every kilogram of CO2 that we add to the atmosphere is going to stay up there for a very long time. And so effectively, it's very hard to reverse any of the warming that's already happened. So in that extent, it's kind of a point of no return. But one of the really critical things here is that we still have a lot of agency and control over how warm we allow it to eventually get, right? And so from that perspective, there is no kind of tipping point or game over. It just really means that we can kind of steer the ship towards a future that will be more beneficial and maybe easier to adapt to if we're actively dealing with the problem compared to if we ignore it. And so, you know, I would say that anything we can do to reduce the highest levels of warming, anything we can do to avoid the worst case scenarios is a win and something that we can achieve.
Benjamin Cook, thank you so much for taking time to talk with us about climate change and how NASA is keeping an eye on the good planet Earth.
Thank you very much.
That was Benjamin Cook, a scientist with the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies in New York. I'd like to remind you that Press Conference USA is available for free download from our website, voanews.com/PCUSA, and many streaming services such as Apple Podcasts. We also hope you'll get in touch with us either through Facebook or Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or by sending us an old-fashioned email to PCUSA@voanews.com. Let's continue the science edition of Press Conference USA. Today, we're talking about the world coming together for Earth Day and some of the key environmental issues this year's holiday aims to address. My guest for this segment of today's program is Tim Christofferson. He is head of the Nature for Climate branch of the United Nations Environment Program, which is based in Nairobi, Kenya. He joins us today via Microsoft Teams. Tim, why are our ecosystems so important to the health of our planet and its people?
Basically, all the food we eat, of course, depends on healthy ecosystems, but much more than that. Most of the water we drink, 1/3 of all major cities in the world receive their drinking water from forested watersheds, for example. That depends on healthy ecosystems. Fisheries depend on healthy ecosystems. So we are much more dependent on the health of our ecosystems than most people realize. Or in other words, we've taken nature for granted for too long.
What kind of condition are our ecosystems in, and what are some of the causes of their deterioration?
The state of the planet is, in fact, alarming, and it is continuing to further destabilize. We are losing species at a risk that is higher than any time in history since the last major planetary extinction. So we are in the sixth planetary extinction crisis at the moment, and there are an estimated 1 million species at risk of extinction if we don't conserve and restore nature more actively than we've done to date. So there's an urgency to respond. And without action on biodiversity and on saving ecosystems, we can also not reach the Paris Climate Agreement targets.
Tim, can you tell us a bit about the UN Decade on Ecosystem Restoration that will launch on June 5th, which is also World Environment Day?
The UN Decade is a global rallying cry for everybody, all the citizens, local governments, NGOs who want to take action on the combined biodiversity and climate crisis, who want to put the world back on the sustainable track. The UN is calling everybody to action on a 10-year marathon for restoring planet Earth. The goal of the UN Decade is to prevent, halt, and reverse the degradation of ecosystems worldwide, and we need to do that at a significant scale. Luckily, countries have already made significant commitments, over 1 billion hectares, or an area larger than China and about the size of the US, have been committed for restoration on land. We don't have a similar commitment like that for oceans yet, but we are working towards that. So the size of the challenge and of the opportunity is immense.
Along with being called the UN Decade on Ecosystem Restoration, the theme for this year's Earth Day was Restore Our Earth. So can we talk about the different types of ecosystems that need attention, not only with restoration, but with preservations? For example, farmlands.
On Earth Day, we have released a practical guide that you can download on decadeonrestoration.org with guidance on restoring farmlands, forests, mountains, watersheds, oceans, rivers, lakes. For farmlands in particular, they are probably one of the most important ecosystems to restore quickly because they're so essential for our food security. And at the same time, we're losing fertile soils, we're losing soil biodiversity, we're losing the ability of Earth to produce our food. So we need to shift to more sustainable forms of farming. And the world has recognized this. And in September of this year, we are organizing a food systems summit at the UN General Assembly with heads of states and governments to address how we can completely transform the way the world produces its food. And that is, of course, important for all countries in the world that have significant agriculture, but also for those who are significant importers of agricultural commodities.
Another area where ecosystems are in trouble are forests. We've heard all the news about the destroying of the forests around the world. How will this initiative help reforest the planet Earth?
forests are a little bit the pop stars of the ecosystem restoration movement, because everybody knows trees, everybody loves trees, and planting a tree has become a bit of the symbol of ecosystem restoration. And that's a good thing because it can bring more people back in contact with nature, with ecosystems. The world is losing 10 million hectares of forest still every year. And in Africa in particular, that trend has even accelerated in recent years. And we need to turn the tide on deforestation. Clearly, forests are so essential for the biodiversity they harbor, but also for the ecosystem services they provide. There's clear evidence that in areas with intact forests, the level of vector-borne diseases like malaria is lower. Likewise, in areas with high deforestation, the risk of zoonotic diseases like COVID-19 increases because of increased human-wildlife contact. And we have to ensure that forests are intact to the level that they can fulfill their natural ecosystem functions, including provision of drinking water to most of the world's big cities.
Of course, one of the most important elements for life is water, fresh drinking water. What about the ecosystems concerning fresh waters?
Freshwater biodiversity has seen the fastest decline of any ecosystem over the past decades. And that is alarming because the amount of fresh water that we have on Earth is, of course, very limited compared to amount of water that is not accessible as drinking water, either because it's in the form of ice or too far underground, or of course because water is salty in the ocean. So the amount of fresh water we have is limited and dwindling fast. Restoring lakes and rivers in that context is important because we need the natural ability of freshwater ecosystems to regenerate themselves, to also clean themselves, and to ensure that rivers have the quality of water that is required to also serve as a source of drinking water, as a source of water for agricultural production. And all of these services are at the moment at risk.
And of course, a good portion of planet Earth is made up of water, oceans. And as we know, oceans are an incredibly critical ecosystem. What kind of work needs to be focused on oceans?
Oceans are indeed the source of most of the protein for populations along the coast, but also in developing countries that have no other means of achieving a high protein diet. And it is therefore essential that we maintain sustainable fisheries in the oceans. And the picture there at the moment is pretty bleak. We see coral reefs disappearing at an alarming rate. We see other ocean and coastal habitats like seagrass meadows disappear at an alarming rate. And there we need to have clear targets and more specific intervention, like we already have on land with restoration initiatives like the Bond Challenge. We need a Bond Challenge for the oceans and for the coasts, where governments step up and say, we want to restore X number of million of hectares of coastal and ocean habitat. So if governments want to step up, the UN Decade on Ecosystem Restoration now is a good opportunity to do so.
And Tim, finally, at the end of this decade, at the end of the UN Decade on Ecosystem Restoration, what would you like to see accomplished over the decade?
The most important goal we're aiming for is, in fact, going beyond the number of hectares restored. It is a new relationship between humans and nature. We have to ask ourselves, as humans, having come to this crossroad at this juncture of our global civilization, what is our role on this planet? And are we a part of nature or are we apart from nature? A new relationship where we see ourselves as a part of nature and not distinct from nature is important for us to heal the planet, because that also means we can heal ourselves and our role on this planet can turn from one of destruction to one of stewardship. That is what I would like to see at the end of this decade.
Thank you so much for taking time to talk to us today about the ecosystems of the world and the UN Decade on Ecosystem Restoration.
Thank you very much, Rick.
That was Tim Christofferson. He is head of the Nature for Climate branch of the United Nations Environment Program, which is based in Nairobi, Kenya. He joined us today via Microsoft Teams. I'd like to thank Tim and my other guests who took the time to talk with me, Kathleen Rogers, President and CEO of EarthDay.org, and Benjamin Cook, a scientist with the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies. And that's all the time we have for this science edition of Press Conference USA. I'd like to thank Ian Kelly, a producer in our current affairs unit, for his help with this program. And thank you for listening to our program today. This is Rick Pantaleo reminding you to be sure to join Carol Castiel next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.